Iran unveils the and launches the mass production line of a new domestically made training jet. Silicon Valley Bank collapses amid anxiety over its health, marking the second biggest bank failure in US history. And the BBC suspends its veteran presenter over his criticism of the UK government's refugee policy. Welcome. Now, top story, Iran has unveiled and opened the mass production line for a new domestically developed training jet. The state-of-the-art jet, dubbed Yasin, would help trainee pilots get familiar with air combat tactics and techniques. Trainees will also learn the application of different kinds of weaponry on board. The training aircraft is capable of monitoring and recording flight data during and after the flight. It can show and analyze data in a 3D format. Many of the systems installed on the aircraft have already passed standard tests. Some of them will go through final stages of testing during actual flight on the prototype before it goes into mass production. Iran has managed to domestically develop the training jet despite Western sanctions. Iran and Saudi Arabia have agreed to resume diplomatic relations under an agreement mediated by China. This is the reaction of the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council after days of intense negotiations with his Saudi counterpart in Beijing.
At the end of the talks, we reached a decision to start a new chapter after 7 years of severed relations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia, while considering the interests of the two countries, the security and well-being of the region, and preventing undue intervention from extra-regional forces, particularly from the West, and constant mischief by the Zionist regime in the region. We hope that this new chapter will compensate for the stagnation of relations over these last 7 years and also lead to stability and security in the region, as well as the improvement of the welfare of all its people.
Tehran and Riyadh will restore diplomatic ties within 2 months and reopen embassies in respective countries. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says renewing ties offers great potential for the two countries and the region, as well as the Muslim world. China called the restoration of Iran-Saudi Arabia ties a major good news in the current turbulent world, adding that it was a victory for dialogue and peace. The Saudi National Security Advisor has also welcomed the rapprochement.
The kingdom's leadership welcomes the initiative of His Excellency President Xi Jinping, based on the kingdom's consistent and continuous approach since its establishment in adhering to the principles of good neighborliness, taking everything that would enhance security and stability in the region and the world, and adopting the principle of dialogue and diplomacy to resolve differences.
The United Nations, Iraq, Qatar, and the UAE have all hailed the resumption of ties between the two West Asian nations. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement described it as a good development. Yemen's Ansar Allah movement said that Tehran-Riyadh relations will help enhance regional security. The US, however, downplayed the agreement as President Joe Biden is following his predecessor's agenda to push for Israel's ties with Arab states. Meanwhile, the agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran also angered Israel. Former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said Tel Aviv's attempts to isolate Iran have suffered a fatal blow. Sayed Mustafa Khoshcheshm is a political analyst and joins us now live from Tehran for more analysis on this major story. Sayed, several angles to this. So let's start with Iran first. The restoration of diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia is among or in line with President Raisi's strategy to expand regional relations and beyond. Is this one of his perhaps most important achievements to date, or is it perhaps in comparison with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization?
Hello, and thanks for having me. Well, since President Raisi won office, the day after when he was having his first press conference, even before his inauguration, he stressed that he means to improve Iran's trade ties with especially the neighboring states and the regional states. And that's impossible without détente with Iran's regional foe or rival, that's Saudi Arabia. Therefore, he said on the same day that he was ready to reopen embassies in Tehran and Riyadh. And ever since then, there were rounds of talks at the initiative of the Iraqi government in Baghdad. And then during the recent visit by President Raisi to Beijing, the issue was brought up. And the Chinese, of course, took a good stance in this regard and started showing a more assertive role in West Asia. And then that's why the Iranian media are giving wide coverage, because this is called a major achievement for President Raisi's foreign agenda, alongside the Shanghai Cooperation Organization membership, alongside widening strategic cooperation with Chinese as well as the Russians, alongside other plans that are on the way. But this was also a second successful move by Iran in recent weeks after Iran defused the U.S. and the three European states' hostile stances at the Board of Governors of the IAEA for ratifying a resolution against Iran. And Iran could maneuver that with an agreement with the IAEA and through détente policy.
Right.
So these are consecutive in foreign policy.
Sayed, has Saudi Arabia reached a conclusion that it can no longer rely on the United States, especially after Afghanistan, with the withdrawal of the U.S. forces from Afghanistan, that it can no longer rely on the United States for its security, for example, in the war that it waged on Yemen? And is it shifting more towards the East, China in particular? And is it now focusing perhaps more on regional dialogue to achieve peace and stability?
Well, before that, the Saudis tried every possible option in coalition with the United States and Israel against Iran and its allies in the resistance front. It started since Obama was in office. And then it's no secret that they supported the militant groups in Syria and Iraq, and they didn't play a good role in the region. But then the climax was when they asked Donald Trump to go into war with Iran for the sake of Riyadh, and Donald Trump took the ploy in the public and said that he would never go into war with Iran for the sake of Saudi Arabia.
Okay, looks like we've lost Sayed Mustafa Khoshchashm, political analyst. We'll try and get him back for more analysis on that story regarding Iran and Saudi Arabia resuming diplomatic relations. Moving on, Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations has called for a collective effort to fight hate mongering against Muslims, who make up a sizable portion of the world's population. Amir Saeed Iravani was addressing a UN meeting to commemorate the first ever International Day to Combat Islamophobia. Iravani said Islamophobic measures contain hate mongering, discrimination, terror attacks, and violence against Muslims. The senior Iranian diplomat said the Islamic Republic condemns any forms of violence based on religions and beliefs against people around the world. Iravani also denounced Israel's aggression against Islam's third holiest site, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, as well as the regime's atrocities against Palestinians. Last year, the UN General Assembly adopted by consensus a resolution declaring March 15 as an international day to combat Islamophobia. Moving on now, the United States has suffered its second biggest bank collapse in the country's history. Silicon Valley Bank, the 16th largest in the U.S., failed after depositors hurried to withdraw money over concerns of a liquidity crisis. It was the second biggest bank failure after the collapse of Washington Mutual in 2008. Nearly half of the American technology and healthcare companies that once went public, that is, last year, after getting early funding from venture capital firms were Silicon Valley Bank customers. Moreover, a large number of startups will not be able to make payroll at some point in the next month if they cannot access their money. The bank was closed on Friday. The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says the all-out war against Syria has failed. He expressed confidence that Syria would remain at the forefront of resistance against the Israeli regime. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said the growing list of Arab countries seeking to re-establish ties with Damascus is an acknowledgement of Syria's victory. He said the presence of Arab and Western delegations in Damascus is a source of satisfaction. Nasrallah stressed that Syria's resistance disrupted all equations throughout the region. The Hezbollah chief called the U.S. as Syria's main enemy. He pointed out that Washington's sanctions campaign against Damascus is failing with the help of the people and regional allies. Amid growing tensions in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds and an Israeli crackdown on Palestinian prisoners in the regime's jails, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip stage a rally to protest against Israel's violations. Ola from Gaza has more to tell us.
Palestinians in the northern part of the Gaza Strip held a rally after Friday prayers to show support for the anti-occupation operations in the West Bank and to condemn Israeli violations against Palestinians in the occupied territories. Since the start of 2023, Israel has ramped up attacks and raids on Palestinian towns and cities throughout the occupied territories. The attacks have so far left 79 Palestinians killed, including 14 children and a woman.
The Palestinian resistance is united on all fronts. Hamas today is a resistance icon, not only in Gaza, but also in the West Bank and Al-Quds. Yesterday's operation in Tel Aviv is clear evidence that each Israeli action will be met with a Palestinian reaction.
Palestinian protesters chanted slogans hailing the armed resistance and calling for stepping up the acts of resistance as the first option against the Israeli violations. Meanwhile, the National and Islamic Action factions and the Prisoners' Committee of the National and Islamic Forces held the Friday prayers outside the International Committee of the Red Cross headquarters in Gaza. Speaking to Press TV, Azahar confirmed the fact that the resistance in the West Bank is following in the footsteps of the resistance factions in Gaza.
According to our experience in Gaza, the escalation of the resistance will end by liberation of this area. The Israeli came here as an economical project, not ideological project. So if their interest, their income decreased or in danger, they are going to escape.
After the Friday prayers, the National and Islamic Action factions held a press conference in solidarity with the Palestinian prisoners. The Islamic Jihad resistance movement urged the international community to stand by the Palestinian people and support the Palestinian prisoners as they are subjected to humiliating measures imposed by the Israeli prison authorities.
Addressing the international committee to stop the violence and aggressive steps from Ben Gafir toward our detainees in the Israeli jails, and to stop all kind of these steps and to support them and to make enough effort to free especially the women and the children.
As the Israeli regime escalates its violations against the Palestinian prisoners and commits more atrocities in the West Bank and Al-Quds, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are like a keg of gunpowder, ready to explode at any moment in the face of the Israeli occupation. Al-Asif, Gaza.
Turning elsewhere, veteran BBC sports presenter Gary Lineker has been suspended from his position over his criticism of the UK government's refugee policies. The state-funded broadcaster took the decision after government officials demanded action over the presenter's comments. Lineker, who previously hosted refugees in his own home, has tweeted to a video posted by the British Home Office announcing the government's Stop the Boats policy. He called the move, quote, beyond awful. Under its new policy, London would prevent asylum seekers from coming into the country and would instead deport them either back to their own countries or to Rwanda. The decision against Lineker, who is also a former England football captain, has been met with widespread criticism. Outgoing Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon described the move as undermining free speech in the face of political pressure. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. I request all the distinguished ulama, the children of the Quran, and the eminent scholars not to be negligent of this sacred book. Although its different dimensions, stages, and faces are inaccessible to the common people, they should benefit from it to the extent of their knowledge, and through research and use of proper expressions and simple language, they can make use of this inexhaustible treasure of divine mysticism and this great revelation of Muhammad and share it with others.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear audience, you are listening to Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. Well, in this program, what we do is to read some of the valuable speeches of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh and explain about their interpretations. We hope that in that way, we as lovers of this great character would come to a deeper understanding of Imam Khomeini's thoughts and ideologies. Well, about the subject of the religion of Islam, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh held that Islam is for the welfare of the society. Well, about the concepts of welfare, as Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh aptly puts it, it is vivid that in the religion of Islam, every single person is supposed to share his or her income with the Muslim government. In that way, the government must spend that money in favor of the social benefits. For example, apart from the taxes people pay in their income, which is quite common in every non-Muslim society, the Muslims are supposed and asked to pay their homes or one-fifth of their income, as well as zakat, which is the almsgiving of certain belongings to poor people. In that way, the poor will solve some of the financial problems, and in general, such type of payments can enhance the economic status of a Muslim society. The result of such rules is welfare, and you can see that no religion like Islam concerns the poor and sets right for them. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh is referring to this aspect of a Muslim society in which no one is indifferent towards other difficulties. Islamic society in which no one is indifferent towards others' difficulties. Although welfare doesn't only refer to financial issues, mental welfare is another aspect which requires so much attention. In that sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, this aspect has been taken into consideration as well. You know, when the amount of economic difficulties is reduced in a society, people would have more peace and mental welfare. And that is one of the ultimates in the Muslim societies. When people have little or no concerns about financial problems, they would pay attention to charities, religious travels or ziyarah to imam's shrines. And in general, a real Muslim society would be happier and in more welfare in comparison to those non-Muslim countries.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
At the start of World War II, both the Axis and Allied forces had poisonous shells. A total 50,965 tons of poisonous agents were deployed by both sides of the conflict, including chlorine, phosgene, and mustard gas. Official figures declare about 1.3 million casualties directly caused by chemical warfare agents during the course of the war. Yet the end of the war was not the end of chemical weapons. They were dumped into the dark and deadly depths of the oceans. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. From 1917 to 1970, the armies of the world's greatest powers systematically dumped 1 million tons of chemical weapons into our oceans. A military secret so well kept that underwater dump sites remain hidden for several decades. This week's program investigates this untold story of global chemical pollution, which threatens our health, environment, and economy. These deadly poisons are leaking little by little into the sea, threatening fishermen, bathers, fish, and the entire ecosystem. Stay with us for the first part of the program.
I found a report that detailed the movement of chemical weapons from depots and storage areas in the United States in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, that noted that some chemical weapons were disposed of at sea.
If you look at the lake, I mean, everybody's first response is, there's no munitions here. I can't see them. I see this beautiful lake. How can you have munitions? Reality, they're there, and we're paying a price for them.
Time bombs are ticking under the sea. 1 million tons of unused chemical weapons lie on seabeds all over the world, and their contents are leaking. This is an unknown story that cutting-edge science and newly declassified documents are now bringing to light.
Chemical weapons in various forms have a very ancient lineage, but their main military usage has derived from the First World War, where they're used in very substantial quantities. The first major gas attack of any significance was the use of chlorine gas during the First World War across a 6 kilometre front at the Second Battle of Ypres, launched on 22nd of April 1915. Other gases are introduced, but the big breakthrough is in 1917 when mustard gas is used for the first time and it becomes known as the king of the war gases.
The new weapons attacked the body inside and out. First affected were the eyes with a severe burning sensation. Then there would be a painful swelling of the lids, followed quickly by blindness, sometimes permanent, caused by ocular clouding. The lungs were assaulted on a cellular level, prompting coughing, bleeding, blistering of tissue, resulting in respiratory distress, pulmonary edema, and death up to 10 days after exposure. The most noticeable effects were on the skin, where red lesions appeared before erupting into raised blisters filled with yellow liquid, severely painful to the touch.
The interwar period is a very strange period for chemical warfare. Most of the programs are secret, and the intelligence agencies know very little about the extent and depth and the innovations. And like intelligence agencies the world over, that when you don't know the truth, you assume the worst.
This is a new arsenal started at the beginning of the present emergency. It is now in production and can manufacture more mustard gas in one day than was manufactured by us in all of World War I.
The Americans acquire eventually something like 51 million chemical shells, or 1 million chemical bombs, 100,000 spray tanks ready for a chemical war. I mean, their production is colossal, 135,000 tons of gas.
The chemical war that everyone was expecting never took place. At the Potsdam Conference, the victorious Allies decided to split up the enemy's stocks and dump them in the seas. This was considered the safest alternative at the time, and they imposed official secrecy on this policy until 2008. Dumpings took place all over the world, in the Sea of Japan, the Indian Ocean, the Baltic Sea, the North Sea, the North Atlantic, and off the Côte d'Azur in France. Our investigation began in Italy with sea dumping in the Mediterranean. Those dumpings were unknown by the public until Gianluca Defoe, a reporter from Milan, broke the story in his best-selling book, Poisons of State. Documents uncovered by Defoe revealed never-before-known details of how chemical weapons from both sides in the war ended up in the sea. As far as the Italian weapons are concerned, on the Allied side, it was a daring air raid that brought their chemical weapons to the seas. On December 2nd, 1943, the German Luftwaffe bombed the port of Bari, and it unknowingly provoked the biggest chemical disaster in the Mediterranean. The Allies kept secret their chemical weapons shipment for fear of handing the Nazis a huge propaganda victory. This secrecy hindered efforts to effectively treat hundreds of Italian citizens affected when a cloud of sulfur mustard gas wafted over the city. Find a similar situation in the north of Europe and the Baltic Sea. During the Second World War, it was a theater of combat for the navies of Germany, Finland, and the Soviet Union. The Baltic is today, without doubt, considered the most polluted sea in the world. Cold War politics were a major obstacle to the scientific study of the effects of chemical munitions in the Baltic. With the fall of the USSR, Baltic states were now free to do the work. The Polish Academy of Science began ChemSea.
We are 11 institutions all around the Baltic Sea. Countries like Sweden, Finland, Germany, Lithuania and Poland. Now the Baltic Sea bottom become a resource. There are more and more pipelines, windmills, cables and so on being laid on the sea bottom. So it's not really safe to proceed without better knowledge. We are basically performing a risk assessment for the dumped munitions from the Second World War, which resides on the Baltic Sea bottom. And we are trying to assess the location of munition, the pollution of the bottom around it, and the impact it might have on the ecosystem. We are at the Bornholm Deep dump site. It's the biggest single dump site in the Baltic Sea. It's about 30,000 tons of munitions dumped here. They believed if we dump it in the Bornholm Deep, when we've got muddy sediments, it will not propagate to other areas of the Baltic because they thought it is totally inert area. No bottom currents, no water movement. It will stay where it is dumped. Nowadays, we know that the salt water which comes from the North Sea travels through this area and is moved to other areas of the Baltic. So if the sediments are contaminated, it can be a point source of contamination which is spreading to other areas in the Baltic. We decided to collect sediments very close to the objects, like half a meter if possible, and we can only do it with the robot, because with the robot we can take sediment samples which will be most probably contaminated with mustard gas or any other warfare agents. Sometimes you are seeing the encasements which are completely corroded and the actual agent sits on the bottom in lumps. It's leaking into the environment. We do not know the speed of leakage because some objects are completely intact and some of them are completely corroded. And it seems that sea is degrading it to more stable forms, but some of those more stable forms are equally toxic as original agents. Whereas the mustard gas decomposes to thiodeglycol, which can be hydrolyzed completely in the seawater, to sulfur and carbon and hydrogen, so it's pretty much harmless substances. Whereas those compounds which were based on arsenic oil, they are decomposing to inorganic arsenic, finally. And arsenic is, of course, a poison. We launched like three expeditions now to the dumping sites, collecting fish, cod mainly. And what we have seen is the higher frequency of fish diseases and also some impact on the general toxicity because those compounds are highly mutagenic. So our partners from Lithuania were able to see the mutated blood cells. We didn't yet, at least, detect toxic levels of arsenic in tissue, whereas we've been able to detect the arsenic in urine of fish. So it seems that it's affecting the fish health, but actually not to the extent which makes it dangerous to consumption. There are many pollutants in the environment which can cause similar effects, like organic contaminants, heavy metals, and so on. So it seems that chemical munitions are maybe not a single factor, but a factor which enhances the environmental damage.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive.
Can you load in there?
We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist the fishing vessels that have caught chemical munitions. So that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep-sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms. The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on an investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s of barrels and barrels of mustard gas and lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball, laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't had any idea where they would be.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
Baltic Sea fishermen face continuing threats that dangerous bombs or leaked substances will be caught in their nets. Bornholm Island, a Danish island, is in the middle of the Baltic, close to one of the largest dump sites.
I'm fifth generation fisherman on Bornholm. And we have manual, so we can how to deal with this. We have areas where there are dumped chemicals, weapons. The yellow one is a precautionary area, and the red is where we should be extra careful. And you have Bornholm here, you have the Baltic, Gotland in Sweden, and also an area, and a red area for extra precaution.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sador Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. This is for a better life from IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Sayyid Mahdi Tawakkol. I am at your service to talk about another strategy that helps us enjoy a more appropriate life based on the concepts of the Quran and Islamic narrations. Daily life is full of ups and downs. Human life is like a thick and massive book that has as many pages as the days a person have in his life. And every day that passes in a person's life, one page turns and ends. In every day, everything that is written on that page will be realized in a man's life. For example, for me, on my today's page, it is written that I will sleep a certain amount of time, eat a certain portion of food, or a certain amount of hardship or happiness, whatever, will happen to me. And everything written on this page of this day, today, will definitely take place. And when today is over, that page will be flipped and will never be reopened again. However, in many pages of this book, it is written that a sort of hardship will come upon us. I said this to address a basic point that I have in my mind. The point is this: the troubles, problems, and sufferings that plagues human beings is due to some factors. And these factors are completely different. Sometimes it is the direct result of human bad actions, like laziness, not using opportunities, and not paying attention, as I said, to the opportunities. Surely such a person deserves blame, because he misused the fortunes he has in his life and exposed himself to some difficulties. Another factor is that some of these problems are the expiation of man's sins, and God, by these problems, wants to purify man. Because we know that one of the philosophies of hardships is that these hardships wash away people's sins. Therefore, difficulties are actually a kind of mercy from God, because they clean the human soul from the pollution of sins. In addition to this issue, there is a side effect that is unfortunately seen among many people. It is common. Sometimes as soon as people see that someone is in trouble, the first thing that comes to their mind is that this person has committed a sin or bad action that God wants to punish him. In Islam, this attitude is highly condemned. We are not allowed to judge people badly and consider them as sinners. Imam Ali, in one of his noble sayings in Nahj al-Balagha, points to this matter and says, "You cannot blame every person who is caught in problems, since he might be innocent." I translated this narration with a little explanation. The troubles that humans are afflicted with have different philosophies. Sometimes these hardships are only for the reason that God wants to increase the reward of his servant and give him more spiritual rank. A person who suffers from hardships, if he is patient and not ungrateful, will be greatly rewarded by God. Let's go for a short break and I will be back soon.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
I was talking about the difficulties that people are afflicted with that has many philosophies, and there are many reasons behind it that totally differs from one situation to another situation. Sometimes these hardships are to remove the effect of the sins that people commit. Sometimes it is because of the increase of the rewards of those who are patient and At the middle of the difficulties, do not complain of God's decision. Therefore, if we see that someone is afflicted with hardship and calamity, we cannot say that he must have committed the sin so that God wants to punish him with these troubles. Not at all. Let me even add a subtle and meaningful point here. Even if someone has committed a sin, okay, and God has afflicted him with hardship because of that sin, this is a sign of God's love and mercy for that sinful person, since Allah wants to purify him and brings him closer to himself. Therefore, we should not make a wrong judgment about someone who has been loved by God. If God did not love him, he would not have decided to remove his sins with that hardship. This is what Imam Ali pointed to in the mentioned narration, that we should not blame someone who is entangled with problems. In addition, sometimes the problems we face in our life is a kind of divine test. I mean, that God but that hardship wants to cultivate his servant and wants to make him resistant in future. Let me give an example to make this point clearer, that how difficulties in one's life makes him purify and removes the pollution of sins from one's spirit. With regard to extracting gold from stones, this is the example. If there is some gold materials in a mine that is mixed with so many other substances like stone and other materials, if we want to extract the gold from them, it is necessary to put them into a hot furnace. When the gold melts with the intense heat of the furnace, the gold will become separated from the useless stones and those unwanted materials. The problems that humans face is like the same furnace, in which humans are placed into that furnace, so that with the intense heat people see, their pure and valuable nature will be separated from the impurities, defects, and other bad attributes. A man, for example, could be totally impatient, but when he is put into difficulties, he will become a resistant man. Some other people in these problems and difficulties will understand their weak points and may decide to compensate for them, and later on move on with more effort, more energy for a better future. We do not know the philosophy behind the hardships that comes to people. Only God knows the reality of people, and God also covers the flaws and mistakes of people. And because of this, one of the God's attributes is Sattar al-Uyub, which means that he covers the sin of his servants. As a result, we are not allowed to attach false labels to anyone. Let me summarize. If we see that someone is in trouble, we should not think that he is afflicted with that hardship due to a mistake or a sin he committed in his life. Not at all. Sometimes troubles subject the man to a higher reward, makes him closer to Allah. Sometimes troubles are for the test of people. Sometimes it gives people a fortune to remove his weak points. Sometimes troubles is that Allah wants to make the man more patient in the future. Because of this, we should not judge people when we see that they are troubled. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows.
share, he knows. Allah knows.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the